This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Services Leadership, a groundbreaking research center in the W.P. Carey School of Business at Arizona State University. The Center for Services Leadership provides leading-edge research and education in the science of service.
Welcome to the CSL podcast. I'm Darima Fotheringham. Today I'm talking to Scott Bretzman and Mary Murcott. Scott Bretzman is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Customer Care Measurement and Consulting, CCMC. And Mary Murcott is the president of the Customer Experience Institute for Dialogue Direct. They will share insights from the latest customer rage study that CCMC and Dialogue Direct conducted in partnership with W.P. Carey Center for the Services Leadership. Scott, Mary, thank you both for being here today.
Thank you
for having us.
So this is the seventh wave of National Customer Rage Study. When and how did the Customer Rage Study begin?
The concept of a National Customer Rage Study goes all the way back to 2002, but it really wasn't about customer rage. It was much more narrowly conceived of as a replication of a very famous study, a notable White House study from the mid-70s that my colleagues John Goodman and Mark Rayner did for the White House. And it was that seminal piece of work that connected the words quality and profit. And the study hadn't been updated in close to 30 years. So when we founded CCMC, one of the things we wanted to do was continue a tradition that we'd started back in the early days at TARP of providing really good, actionable information in the marketplace about the customer experience. So we said, well, why don't we redo the White House study? And along the way, when we were first conceiving the study, I thought, well, we ought to put in some new things as well. And one of the things that I read in the Washington Post was an interesting article about how local retailers here in the Washington, D.C. area were having trouble holding on to their retail staff because customers were so angry and awful to them and the pay was so low. It struck a chord with me, and I did a literature search and looked around, and there was all kinds of anonyms or acronyms for rage that were out there. It was software syndrome rage and road rage and restaurant rage, but there really wasn't any empirical research, anything meaningful that was even quasi-scientific, with the exception of one study that I think was at the University of Buffalo that talked about angry customers. And it sort of left me feeling, after literature search, that basically people were saying angry customers and customer rage was really the stuff of lunacy. It was hyperbole. It was an exception that it was, you know, just the crazy people that painted their car yellow and stood outside the auto company for lemon law sorts of things. And that didn't seem right to me because I knew that personally I'd gone through my own fits of rage from time to time with products or services. So anyway, long story short, we added a question or two on rage. Well, the rest, as they say, is history, because the first rape study we came out with published in the Wall Street Journal, and it continues to enjoy coverage in the popular press and a lot of other places. But I'd make these other two side notes about the genesis story of customer rage. You know, first, I think part of the reason that so many are attracted to it, outside of some of our friends in the corporate world that manage customer care, but part of the reason people are so attracted to it is everybody has their own personal story of rage. And a lot of times when we present the rage study, everybody comes with their own passionate stories about their worst product and service experiences, and everybody gets really jazzed up before we even start talking about data. So I think part of the reason the rage study is connected is tied to that. And then I would say as well that it's the only longitudinal study now that offers credible, trustworthy data about the complaining experience. You know, there's lots of other studies out there like the American Customer Satisfaction Index, there's plenty of J.D. Powers things, et cetera, et cetera. But this is the only study that really, over the course of now, in effect, four decades, provides a credible view of what it's like to deal with a company when you have a problem. And I think that's a really important part of the rage story.
Right. And looking at the data collected over the years, what can you say about the most common triggers of customer rage, let's say 10, 15 years ago and now, and have they changed?
Good question. About 10 or 15 years ago, we led a simpler life. The cable companies were not in telephone service, were not in security service, were not in wireless service. And as we started bundling services in the banks and in telecommunications, we've seen the complexity rise. You know, and not only has the complexity risen because we have bundled services, but companies have actually listened to their customers and added a lot of features and add a lot of channels in which they can communicate. So that's causing a lot of customer bouncing from one representative to another representative. So I think the common trigger is complexity. The features have gotten complicated, so they have more reason to call because it's not intuitive how to use the product or service. And then secondly, they don't know who to call within the company. And lastly, the company isn't really sure because the representatives haven't been clearly trained, or they lack a common database about customers, a common database about knowledge. And so that's become a real problem. So I think it's complexity that is driving the rage at this point.
And going into the latest customer rage study, did you have any predictions about what you'll find? Were those predictions confirmed? Were there any surprises?
So what's interesting of sort, depending on how you look at it, this is turning a lemon into lemonade, is that a lot of times the rage data over the course of these seven times we've done it hasn't really moved very much. Sometimes the key indicators are sort of static, or now we're starting to see, now that we have a longer-term view, that's why the longitudinal view is so important, things can move just a little bit, but over the course of seven times over 13 years or so, every little bit adds up to a lot. So there's a, you know, a slower decline maybe, but things are in decline for some of these really important measures. So we keep waiting for some sort of sea change, you know, some kind of positive traction in these KPIs, but we haven't seen any. Initially, in the first few years of the study, I'd say we were surprised by the order of magnitude of unhappiness or discontent with complaint handling. We knew from our proprietary work that we've done for many decades that it's probably fair to say many companies that complaint handling isn't their core competency. We knew that to be true. I think what we were surprised at initially was just how many companies were so bad at complaint handling, and that continues to be the case today. But you know, as far as predictions, sort of like Linus and Lucy waiting in the pumpkin patch, we keep going every year or every other year when we do the rage study and hoping to see the, you know, the great pumpkin here of change in some of these key indicators, but every year we're walking back at the end of the night with our blanket in our hand and nothing's really happened. I will say that's created a certain imperative for us to continue to explore the why and the how of rage. And this year, one of the things we did, and we do a little bit something different every time we do the study to kind of delve deeper, we looked at the most annoying phrases that are part of the customer care lexicon, and we had folks rate 15 different common phrases that they would often hear when they're engaged in the business of trying to get their problem solved. I think these, to some degree, when you reflect on them, they have a lot to do with why somebody might say, I didn't really get anything, or they might encourage people to be a little bit more enraged, or they might create the feeling that the company really isn't putting itself in my shoes, which is one of the things that people often want. So the top five of these annoying phrases, things that you know many people thought should be quote-unquote banned from customer care kinds of conversation, your call is important to us, please continue to hold. Number two, that's our policy. Number three, we're currently assisting other customers. Your call will be answered in the order in which it was received. Number four, can I get your account information again? How many times have we heard that and just wanted to take the phone and throw it through the wall because you just spent 10 minutes entering in all of the information that they're going to ask for again. And number five, please give me top scores on all the questions in the after-call survey, you know, begging for positive reviews. So those are palpable annoyances for customers, and they're big contributors to the lousy experience that we're, at least by the rage study, so often been happening. And, you know, I don't know that there's, again, any great quote-unquote news to those as much as there is maybe a disappointment that in this day and age when customer care has really become so pivotal and so much has been invested that we're still having these kinds of conversations about what could be improved.
Mm-hmm. Dareema, I think from my point of view, I only had one surprise. I would hope to have been surprised by some positive changes. I wasn't. The one surprise I had, and I guess looking back and reflecting on it, I shouldn't be surprised, was the amount of rage. It really increased. And I look at one statistic in particular, and the amount of revenge over 2 years increased from, they wanted revenge on the company. So it went from 3% to 24% in 2 years. So that surprised me, but it shouldn't have, because I think when we look at politics and the overall community, and I say the general consumer community, about how they're being governed, how they're being managed, how their large corporations are treating them, they're really starting to revolt. And I think that's what we saw about the revenge going from 3% in 2 years to 24% in terms of what they wanted out of the complaint handling process. So it's disturbing, but I think it's understandable.
Mm. Were there any other interesting trends and statistics?
I would add two additional statistical trends, if you will, that stick out. One, and this relates to channel, 72%, and that's the percentage of complainants that cite those who had a problem, complain, those that cite the telephone as their primary channel for complaining, which is more than a 6-to-1 margin versus the internet. And I think you're on firm ground, as in our business, if what you're doing is telling organizations they really need to be vested in a multi-channel approach, that they need to optimize all the new kinds of digital ways of communicating. Those are all really important. That's not the argument being made here. However, when somebody has a problem, their go-to channel is the telephone. I think that's a surprise to people, if you want to go back to surprises. And I think it's also a warning to companies that, you know, you can't forget about that channel for these sort of problem handling scenarios, because sorting out, to Mary's point about complexity of problems and products and services, sorting some of these things out is not easy, and it isn't going to be resolved in a 142-character tweet. You have to actually talk to people in order to resolve some of these problems. So that's one. The second one is one I made reference to earlier, which is over the course now of four decades, in 1976, the percentage of households that were satisfied with the way a company responded to their question or their problem was 23%. So almost a quarter of one of every four customers in response to their most serious problem was going to be satisfied. Here we are in 2016 now, when the study was done in 2015, only 17%. Mm-hmm. How is it possible over four decades of work, advancement, that we've actually lost ground? That still, I think, is a phrase we'll repeat often in the 13 or so years we've done the RAGE study, but it's one that merits repeating and merits attention. If that trend were to continue, I guess by the time, I would be retired, I don't know about Mary, that trend will bring that number down into the single digits. So that's what we hope doesn't happen.
So it seems like many companies are still struggling to provide great customer care, but do you think that customers are also becoming more demanding these days, and what can we learn about the customers from this study?
Great question. There's a couple of ways to think about them. You know, the first question of, are customers more demanding? You know, many companies believe this to be true. One of the more common reactions that I would hear to the RAGE study, particularly in the earlier years, is that, well, we're doing plenty, but you can't please everybody, and especially today's customers who are overly demanding and unreasonable. And I don't buy that premise when I look at the RAGE data. You know, first, to Mary's point earlier, problem experience is up. In 1976, the percentage of households with a problem was 32%, and in 2015, it's 54%. That's a big increase, and I think that's despite tremendous increases in the quality of products and services. You know, take automotive, for instance. You know, quality there is really, really improved. But in this global, digital, outsourced, co-branded, make incremental revenue model type marketplace, I think, you know, it's entirely fair to say that complaint handling is even more important than it ever has been. It has more impact because of this increased problem experience than it ever has before. But secondly, to this issue of, are they more demanding, oftentimes the corporate response will be, well, they want unreasonable things. We can't give them what they want. They want money. and they want free products, and they want to cheat us. And significant efforts in many cases set up to detect and find the one person out of 1,000 that's completely dishonest and unreasonable, while at the other end of the continuum, you know, are a bunch of customers that want things that don't cost anything. Most of the things that customers want, we find in the RAGE study, have no cost, and they're things that you would imagine would be provided. The number one thing that they want is to be treated with dignity. The number two thing that they want is for a company to put itself in the customer's shoes. And you go down that list, I think 7 of the first 8 are things that have nothing to do with money. They have to do with these simple non-monetary remedies. Companies, many, aren't set up to talk to customers. You know, we said that the channel of preference for complaining is telephone, but whenever I call a contact center now, I dread it. I'm trying to sort out some sort of serious problem I've had in a household. It's awful. I mean, you have to go through this entire daisy chain that starts with the automated telephone and then continues with agents that, you know, might say something like, hello, who do I have the pleasure of speaking with? All of the annoying phrases that we've talked about, you know, become part of the conversation. That's not a dialogue. That's not a conversation. So when you look at, are they more demanding? I don't think they're more demanding. I just think that companies, to some degree, when they don't get this right, have divorced themselves from what the reality of a genuine conversation is.
You know, Scott, I agree with you on so many of your points. I don't know if customers are more demanding. I think they're certainly more discerning. They're certainly making comparisons with other industries, saying, hey, if USAA can do it, why can't you, even though you're not in the insurance industry? I also agree with Scott around, you know, a lot of companies are creating policies and procedures and audit and legal are creating things around the few dishonest people, either employees or customers. And the companies I've worked for that I really admired, and American Express is one of them, one of the things they taught me and one of the values they had is assume positive intent, that you build policies for the vast majority of people, and that you audit for the other things. And I think that somehow both legal and finance have taken over a lot of companies in the game towards looking towards the bottom line. And I see that when I look at complexity, when I look at the companies that aren't doing well and the kind of industries, you know, it's the 3 C's. I talked about complexity, but it's 2 other things as well, and that's compliance and change. Also driven by those legal people saying you can't apologize. So the complexity and change, I see that the amount of change and the compliance is driving a scripted response. I see so many scripted responses, and sometimes you have to do it because, you know, legal or the government has told you have to say it exactly that way so the customer's not getting scammed. But then what I see is the entire conversation becomes scripted. And when people call a call center, what they're really looking for is a relationship. They're looking for the empathy. They're looking for something that only a true person can give them. And when we come back with a scripted response, it's a real problem. The other thing that customers really want is they want a true and sincere apology, not a we're sorry, but an I'm sorry. And we need to train empathy. When I look at the best companies out there that do this, they stop training so much on policy and procedure. They'll train on how to look up the policy and procedure, but they train more on relationship management skills. That's why people are using the telephone. They crave a relationship with these companies so that exceptions can be made, that people really listen to their side of the story. That's really hard to do in email or chat online. You can't have a relationship over a computer. You need to hear the empathy and the sincere apology that's behind that company. So what's interesting to me is that 50% of most companies that I talk to, and I actually did an informal survey the other day, and it was 56% of companies will not let their employees apologize. And why? It's because of assumed liability. And what we found is that if a sincere apology is offered, you have less likelihood of being sued. So, you know, again, I think who's really running these companies, people that care about customers in a marketing department, or is it legal and finance that are doing it to their own detriment, by the way?
Oh, that's great insight. Thank you, Mary. But what else can companies take away from the customer RAGE study? Is there anything that we haven't discussed?
I think we need to make it easier to complain. One of the big concerns, if you think about it, is that even if a customer is completely satisfied with the complaint handling process, that 52% of them still will not recommend your company. So I think we need to make it easier for customers to complain so that you are consciously knowing what's happening to your company. Because if you don't make it easy for them to complain and they have this thing that I think my good friend John Goodman calls trained helplessness, they stop complaining because they get nothing for complaining.
Right.
They go away and they go to your competitor and you don't even know that you have a problem with your company or with that customer. They just go away. So I think making it easier to complain and then actually doing something about it, not only that complaint, but the root cause of the problem. You need to make it easier for company or for people to do business with our companies. So you've got not only make it easier and get more complaints in the door, but secondly, you have to fix that problem on the first call and give them what they really want. And then lastly, do some root cause analysis and eliminate the problem, because even if you satisfy that customer, they're not going to recommend you 52% of the time.
I'm going to suggest that too many companies live in a state of blissful ignorance about the quality of the service that they're providing. And that's often because they have such tepid, ineffectual metrics by which to assess the quality of their service. Their metrics are insincere. No one, no company, if they looked at the RAGE results or looked at their own company results for this sort of activity, would accept the levels of performance that you see. No one that's still working, because they wouldn't have a job. And so you have to believe that while intentions may be good, that oftentimes, to Mary's point, people that are making decisions about, let's just say, these contact centers that we've been referring to, if we're going to concentrate on the telephone, the folks that are making decisions don't have the right information to really understand what the quality of service is. And when you think about in contact centers today, at least by my experience, a lot of the sorts of measures are tending towards validating that things are okay. For example, the use of quality assurance metrics. I've yet to walk into a contact center that if quality assurance statistics didn't suggest that 90 to 98% of the compliance requirements have been met, which is translated then to these were really, really good calls. And when you think about some of the things that are being monitored, some of them legal, to Mary's point, some of them marketing related. I mean, these requirements that you say a customer's name twice or three times, completely meaningless from a customer satisfaction standpoint. Absolutely no relevance at all to the kinds of KPIs we've been talking about, like getting what you want and satisfaction with the call, feeling as if you've got something. But yet, those are featured criteria in many call quality evaluations or IVR surveys, which now are really, really prevalent. It's hard to make a call and not have the automatic invite, sometimes administered via the automated telephone, sometimes via the rep. And then you take the survey and it's three or four questions. Well, one of the most important things that can happen in many contact centers, particularly if you have a problem, is follow through. You have to fix a bill, you have to send something out, you have to call a retailer. There's all kinds of different follow-ups that are required. Well, an IVR survey doesn't measure that at all. It's much like the old days in airline sorts of measurement where they wouldn't measure they'd hand you the thing before you got off the plane, and it didn't include anything on baggage. And what was one of the most frustrating parts of flying then and now is the baggage experience. So a lot of the strategic emphasis should be placed on better self-awareness, better corporate self-awareness, which to my mind has a lot to do with using more metrics with teeth of the variety that appear in the RAGE study.
Great. Mary, do you have anything to add?
What I would say is companies need to listen to the RAGE study and then translate it into action. I talked to so many new MBAs that are put in charge of the call center, put in charge of customer satisfaction or customer experience officers who will look at the study and they don't really know what to do with it. And for me, it's loud and clear. I mean, there's probably 10 or 15 things that they want banned from the call center culture or multi-channel culture in terms of practices that we do that annoy them. And then secondly, there is a framework, in my opinion, in the RAGE study for building a true service recovery program that really delivers long-term loyalty. I mean, what we have from the customer is 12 things that they want in order of magnitude, and we know that they need both monetary and non-monetary. We know they want to be treated with dignity, which means they want to be heard and really listened to, so not interrupted with, I know what the problem is, I can fix it for you, but they want to tell their whole story. They want an apology. So I think that the customer rage study gives us framework and actual action items that we can go do to change things. But what I hear from most executives, and especially people right out of grad school, is they don't know what to do with the data. They think it's interesting. But it stops there, and it really shouldn't. It is such a great framework for change and action. So I think that moving the study from interesting into action is where we need to go next.
Great. What would you like to see in the results of the next wave of the customer rage study? Will there be another one?
Well, there should be another study. You know, as going back to the very beginning of our time together today, I noted that perhaps the thing that we're most proud of is that it offers a longitudinal view. I know we're all committed to seeing through more rage studies. To Mary's point, I would second it and third it and fourth it that we're unlikely to see big changes in some of these numbers that we hoped we would until some of the fundamental transformational changes in strategy are made at a more national or global level, you know, whether it's some of the things related to outsourcing or how you train or the kind of metrics you use. But we'll keep trying. We'll leave the light on. We'll be around.
I would like to see a companion study to the next rage study, and that's one that takes a look at those people who have vastly improved their scores, those industries. And there are other studies out there where we can see huge changes year over year in complaint handling and improvement in customer satisfaction that translates to loyalty. And I'd love to see a correlation study with them where we ask the companies that have actually moved the numbers to say, what did they do? And see if it correlates with the rage study. I bet it does. And I think that that's more proof to companies that they need to get on with it and use the rage study as a framework for action.
I'll leave my remarks with this one additional point, building on Mary's hope for the companion study. The study I've always wanted to do alongside the customer rage study is the employee frontline service version of rage study, where we are able to get insights from those we rely on to help us about the types of experiences they have with customers and what their suggestions would be for how to get more bees with honey, what their ideas would be about how customers can conduct themselves differently in order to make for a better relationship and a better service experience. Because, you know, truth be told, if the higher order aspiration here is to conduct business in the context of a relationship, well, you have to have two to make a relationship at least. And it goes both ways. But we've never been able to find company that would be willing to let us have access to their frontline service folks to ask some of these really important and telling kinds of questions. We've tried a number of times, but I'm still hopeful, as Mary is, that maybe we'll be able to do some of these creative things.
In conclusion, and I know you've given really great advice to companies, is there another advice you would like to add? What one advice can you give companies to get us there, to get us where we want to be in terms of customer satisfaction and the relationship building between the companies and customers and frontline employees?
I think the one thing that I have not mentioned that I wanted to was a common knowledge management database across channels and across departments. So many times customers get flip-flopped because things are changing so much, and I mentioned that's one of the three C's. But there's no common knowledge database that is not Google style, but is more context related in terms of what customers really want and drive to a good answer. When we ask customers in our own studies, proprietary studies at Dialogue Direct, what do customers really want? The number one thing is they want a knowledgeable person. And I think they want knowledgeable channels too. So if they're on the internet and they're looking at it, they're getting the same answer. Knowledge management systems that I've seen out there are pretty archaic. We found a good one at Dialogue Direct that we use, and we've seen huge changes in customer satisfaction and what we call in the industry first contact resolution statistics, where we actually are solving the customer's problem on the first call. And that's the number one thing we hear that customers want out of a person. Now, they want a good relationship and they want knowledgeable and friendly, but because time is money to them, and that's one of the big things that came out of the study, is they're equating time with money. Don't waste my time with someone that isn't really knowledgeable, and that knowledge comes from a good system that backs them up.
Scott?
Mary said it all. She had the last word.
Oh, my gosh, Scott. I can't believe it. Thank you.
Well, Mary, Scott, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for making us part of it.
For more information on the science of service, visit the Center for Services Leadership on the web at wpcary.asu.edu/CSL.